of all, I'd like to thank Roger for his wonderful hospitality here. And I've greatly enjoyed my stay at Waterloo and talking to all the people. My talk today is going to be about this particular material, ytterbium titanium oxide, which we believe is probably the best understood quantum spin ice system. And it's based on work done in collaboration with my student Ryan Applegate and postdoc Robert Hare, and a large group of collaborators who are stationed here. And in fact, I feel like this whole week I've been trying to substitute for Michelle, occupying his office, talking to his students and postdocs, and now trying to give this seminar, which he is eminently more qualified to give, really, because much of what I'm going to say I've learned from him. And his student, Tauran, who's in the audience here, and his undergraduate student, Alex Day, and some experimental work by Kate Ross and Bruce Collin. So the outline for my talk is going to be as follows. I'd like to begin with sort of a broad introduction to frustrated quantum spin systems and also experimental searches for quantum spin liquids. I then focus on these ice rules and quantum spin ice, what's the idea of quantum spin ice, and discuss this particular material, some properties of this material that we have calculated using numerical link cluster expansions, the one regime where we understand this the model, the theoretical model well, is if we can dial down quantum fluctuations, and we'll see that actually it leads to a very simple classical ground state, but excitations which still remain non-trivial, and end with some summary of where one might find this quantum spin liquid phase in these materials. Okay, so this is perhaps well known to most people here, but I'm still going to repeat this. So frustration in classical spin systems leads to ground state degeneracy. So in particular, if we just have a single triangle and we have Ising spins which can point up or down coupled by antiferromagnetic interactions, then we know that 6 out of the 8 spins are basically ground states of that system, are the lowest energy states. And really, if we couple triangles together by sharing bonds, for example, and make a triangular lattice, the triangular lattice Ising model was solved by Wannier around 1950 or so, where he showed that this model has no finite temperature phase transition, but T equals 0 is really like a critical point where the correlation link diverges. And in fact, there's substantial residual entropy in the ground state. About 50% of the total entropy stays in the system even at T equals 0. And actually, if we take the Kagome lattice Ising model, which is also an exactly soluble model, there one is really connecting these triangles by corners, by sharing corners, and that model is even more disordered. Even at zero temperature, it has a finite and very short correlation length, and the ground state entropy is about 72% of total entropy. So if we have a classical system with a large degeneracy, the question is, what would quantum fluctuations do? Well, the simplest possibility is really what has been called order by disorder by various people in the field. It's really a selection of classical order due to fluctuation. And that basically means the lifting of the accidental degeneracy of many states due to fluctuations or disorder. A simple example of this would be if we consider the J1, J2 Heisenberg model. This is a canonical example. So imagine having a Heisenberg model with nearest neighbor interaction J1 and a second neighbor interaction J2. And a situation where J2 is actually very large. If J2 is very large, then basically the two sublattices align antiferromagnetically, but classically they are free to rotate with respect to each other. And this is classical. Once one allows for quantum fluctuation, it actually selects this collinear phase where both sublattices become collinear, and you get either ferromagnetism in one direction and antiferromagnetism in the other direction. And this physics is possibly relevant to the iron nictide family, has been discussed a lot in that context. There's also a beautiful example of selection of order in XY spin ice, this material recently brought up by Savary et al. And Zitomirsky et al., but I'm not going to discuss that here today. So another thing that quantum fluctuations can do, basically they can lead to superposition of states, and we know that they can lead to novel order parameters, the simplest of which is really valence bond order. So superposition of spins can lead to this entangled state, a valence bond or a singlet pair. And if one has valence bond order on a lattice, that usually breaks translational symmetry. So for example, this well-studied model going back to the 60s, the Majumdar-Ghosh model, which is a J1, J2 model in one dimension, is known to have exact ground states, two degenerate ground states which are dimerized. And in two dimension, the best studied model with valence bond solid order is this model proposed by Anders Sandvik called the JQ model. So that's another thing that can happen. But the thing that is most exciting and is the main reason why people are so interested in quantum spin systems that is that quantum fluctuations can also lead to a highly resonating quantum superposition of states, something that would be called a quantum spin liquid. This was first introduced by Phil Anderson. So this resonating valence bond state can have all kinds of exotic emergent properties. It can have fractional excitations, that is excitation that like spin-ons that carry fractional quantum numbers. It can have topological order. There can be exotic quantum criticality. And many of these ideas are beautifully championed in this book by Xiaogang, Quantum Field Theory of Many Body Systems. the issue that I'd like to focus on really is, do real materials exist which show such emergence, such emergent properties? And let's exclude one dimension where things can be understood in much simpler ways, actually. So what are the signatures of such emergent behavior? So for a long time, theorists were mostly arguing that quantum spin liquid means you don't see this and you don't see that. There were only negative signatures that when you don't see something, that's a quantum spin liquid. Fortunately, over the last few years, techniques have started to develop that can actually give you positive signatures of quantum spin liquids. And Roger is clearly a leader in showing both that topological entanglement entropy as well as large anomalous dimensions can be really positive signatures of quantum spin liquid phases. As far as specific models are concerned, the original Anderson proposal was made for the triangular lattice Heisenberg model, but I think there is growing numerical evidence that this model actually has long-range order. However, I must say that to this day, I have not seen a good experimental example of a triangular lattice Heisenberg model where long-range order has definitively been seen. The one model that has attracted a lot of interest is this Kagome lattice Heisenberg model. And while there were many earlier suggestions, including ours, of valence bond solid phases, I think the recent really 2D force work by Steve White strongly suggests that this model is a Z2 quantum spin liquid. There have also been other models like the honeycomb lattice Hubbard model at intermediate U. At small U, this is a semi-metal, basically a Dirac metal. And at large U, it's a nail state. But at intermediate U, there are suggestions that there could also be some kind of a quantum spin liquid there. The triangular lattice Hubbard model also at intermediate U, some work by Motronich, earliest work, basically using variational methods, suggests that there could be a quantum spin liquid there. And of course, there's been a lot of work on quantum dimer models. I think the existence of spin liquid phases is rather well established there. But the connection of dimer models to experiments is rather tenuous. I mean, I haven't seen any place where they have actually been used to study experimental properties. One very interesting suggestion recently is that the simple model that has been studied a lot, the square lattice J1, J2 model, could also be a Z2 quantum spin liquid. I learned from Bhaskaran yesterday that it could also be a chiral spin liquid. And of course, there have been proposals of valence bond solid. So clarifying this could be quite interesting, really. Okay, so let me, after this quick summary of the experimental, of the theoretical status, let me go over to the experimental status. One of the cleanest experimental system is really helium-3. And helium-3, when in three dimension, the BCC helium-3 actually is known to order antiferromagnetically. So its heat capacity, for example, shows a very sharp peak like this. And below this peak, it orders into an up-up, down-down phase, a special kind of antiferromagnetic phase. when helium-3 layers are put on graphite, the first layer is very inert because it's because it can't move on this on the graphite surface. But the second layer can be mobile, and it turns out it forms a triangular lattice where 1/4 of the spin are much less mobile than the others. And so it's also a representation basically of a Kagome lattice Heisenberg model. And the experimental evidence, really, this is the experimental data over here. There's a log-log plot. And you can see that basically the heat capacity at low temperature seems to have some kind of a power law behavior. The susceptibility at low temperature is finite. There are attempts to model this using these multi-spin exchange models, but you can see that those models all produce gap behavior at low temperature. So here's an experimental system, very clean. There is no evidence of order. It's suggestive of spin liquid behavior, but it's clearly a gapless spin liquid. Okay, another model that has attracted a lot of interest is really the Herbert-Smithites, which is really structurally a very good realization of Kagome lattice, structurally perfect Kagome lattice. And in that case as well, when one looks at the experimental data, so this is, say, the AC susceptibility and at low frequencies as a function of field, and this is looking at the susceptibility as a function of frequency. Basically, there is no sign of any spin gap. That's the main message. I don't want to go into the details of this material over here. There is no sign of a gapped spin liquid, as one would have expected from theory. So for some reason, the experiments are giving one gapless spin liquids. Well, these materials, the organic molecular crystals, have also attracted a lot of interest. There are many, many candidate materials for spin liquids. But once again, any evidence for a spin gap is very tiny. So there is this material, which is this one, BDTTTF kind of material, which does not order at least down to 3,000 times lower temperature compared with J, but essentially has a finite susceptibility as T goes to zero. Okay, there is this other material which is really quite interesting because it has a very large thermal conductivity at low temperature, and essentially it's a insulating material with very large thermal conductivity. So that's quite interesting, but again, no sign of a spin gap. So clearly, all these examples of potential spin liquid materials, the one thing that is very interesting is that they don't show any spin gap. Okay, so we don't have a good theory for that. Okay, so now I'm going to basically talk about these spin ice materials and why we think that, you know, this might be the ideal place to actually have it truly confirmed. So I should say, in most of these systems, one thing that one has to worry about is, are there other degrees of freedom interfering? So for example, in these organic molecular crystals, they're very large molecules, and there may be other rotational degrees of freedom which could contribute to some of these thermal conductivity and so on. Okay, so that's not been ruled out. And also in the Kagome material, there's known to be all kinds of disorder there. So it's possible that the system have other degrees of freedom which make it gapless. Okay, so let's see this. These ice rules, the spin, to understand the spin ice material, let me start the story basically by talking about the ice rules. Maybe they are well known to most of the people here. Basically, ordinary ice, that is water, basically a molecular crystal of water, consists of oxygen molecules, which are shown by these solid white spheres. They basically are they form a four-fold coordinated lattice, which could be a layered hexagonal lattice or a pyrochlore lattice. So a four-fold coordinated lattice where there are two hydrogen atoms near each atom. But actually, on all the four, if we focus on any one of the oxygen atoms, it has four bonds. And there's supposed to be one proton on each one of the four bonds. But basically, there were ice rules which were developed by people like Bernal and Fowler, which suggests that two of the protons must be close to one oxygen and two must be far away, thus giving us basically a molecular H2O solid. Linus Pauling recognized very early on that this kind of a system has actually a residual entropy. There's exponentially large number of states, okay, that will satisfy the ice rule. So the ice could be in any one of these configurations, and that implies a very large residual entropy. Phil Anderson basically showed that if we have spins on a pyrochlore lattice, and if we had an icing system, basically that will have exactly the same residual entropy. So in particular, the realization in the spin ice materials is that one has this pyrochlore lattice, which is a lattice of corner sharing tetrahedron. And if you have ferromagnetic interaction between the spins, then essentially that leads to a low energy configuration on the tetrahedron in which two spins must point in and two must point out. And so the low energy configuration that satisfy that spin ice rule are exactly the same as those that satisfy the ice rule. So that's why this is called spin ice. And this system should have a residual entropy. And indeed, in this paper by Ramirez et al. In 1999, it was found that if you take this particular material, dysprosium titanium oxide, and you measure it, its heat capacity, the integral actually gives you this missing entropy, R log 2 minus this in zero field. That's what happens in a magnetic field. So in zero field, it gives you this missing entropy, which is exactly the value that Pauling had calculated. So this, of course, the whole study of classical spin ice physics has been a great success story, and all kinds of interesting phenomena associated with monopoles, and which are also called spin-ons, and classical gauge fields and Coulomb phase have been rather well established, and even some important prizes have by now been awarded. So this field is well set. What we want to talk about, and according to Leon Balance, this should be called the second ice age, really. So the first ice age is sort of over now. Let's talk about the second ice age, which is really adding quantum fluctuations to spin ice. Okay, and that is what one would call a quantum spin ice. So what happens when we add quantum fluctuation? The most exciting possibility, which was first laid out in this paper by Michael Hermele, Fisher, and Balance, is that weak quantum fluctuations on top of this highly degenerate subspace can lead to a very exciting possibility. It can lead to a quantum spin liquid, which is really a novel phase with charges, maybe not novel to many people in the audience here, but from an experimental point of view, a novel phase which will have electric monopoles, magnetic monopoles, and photons, basically a full-fledged fictitious quantum electrodynamics. So with apology to the experts over here, I'm going to just go over. I also wrote a physics article. I was asked to write one on a recent experimental paper. So just very quick summary of how I see this spin ice behavior, this emergent quantum electrodynamics. I'm just going to go over that very briefly here. So first, let me talk about the perturbation theory. The argument that was made by Hermele, Balance, and Fisher first starts with perturbation theory, which is very simple. So imagine that you have this H naught, which gives you the spin ice configuration. So all the spin ice configurations are degenerate ground states as far as this H naught Hamiltonian is concerned. And you add to this perturbation, which is really, which can flip a pair of spins, Si plus Sj minus nearest neighbor spins. So if we add this perturbation, then it's clear that if we try to do degenerate perturbation theory in this spin ice subspace, the lowest order, the first order perturbation doesn't do anything, because if you flip a pair of spins, you will always create go into an excited state manifold. Second order also does not do anything, because you can start, basically you can go to outside and then come back to the same state. And for every state, every spin I state has equal number of anti-parallel spins, so that essentially the second order perturbation theory, just degenerate perturbation theory, just gives you a constant. So again, nothing happens, no selection. But if you go to the next order, in third order, you basically generate this ring term. So if you start with a spin ice configuration where the spins are arranged in the in-out, in-out, in-out fashion over here, third order perturbation theory allows you to tunnel into this out-in, out-in, out-in state, basically. So this, this obviously, this kind of a selection promotes a highly resonating state. Okay, so one can then add a chemical potential for the occurrence of such configurations. And this kind of a model with a K term and a mu term can be fine-tuned basically to a Kivelson-Roxer type equal superposition state, which is where you know all the interesting things happen. You get the quantum equal superposition state and a quantum spin liquid. And this picture has gotten a lot of numerical support by Damley and Isakov and collaborators, and also on the on this dimer model basically by Nick Shannon and collaborators. So I want to, with apology to the experts, just say briefly about how I see the quantum electrodynamics mapping arising in this particular system. So the spin ice subspace, so one way to phrase the interesting question is, you know, the spin ice subspace is a low energy subspace, which is of course separated from the rest. How can disturbances travel without an energy gap? And the answer is just as electromagnetic waves travel in quantum electrodynamics through the solution of Maxwell's equation. So I want to very briefly discuss how that arises here. So first of all, the spin configurations, they define vector fields. Okay, so let's just think of our original spin configurations as vector fields, and they live on the original pyrochlore lattice. And you, one can imagine joining these, drawing these lines all the way to the center over here. So one would get continuous lines over here. The source of this, one could say, lives on the centers of the tetrahedra. And the centers of the tetrahedra form a diamond lattice. So one could say that anytime we have only two in and two out configuration, then there's no source, there's no divergence of this electric field. If there is, if you have any other, if you have three in, one out, for example, that's like having a monopole, either electric or magnetic. So far, this is all classical, and you can call it either magnetic field and magnetic monopoles or electric field and electrical charges. The spin ice community has called this a magnetic monopole. But so for our purposes, to make the analogy with Dirac's theory of quantum electrodynamics, it's useful to call that electric field and electrical charges. Okay. So now quantum mechanics, the new thing that quantum mechanics brings us is that it allows for superposition. So you, a spin can not only be in an up or down state, but it could be in a superposition of the two states with a phase phi, let's say, that determines cosine phi being the amplitude for up and sine phi being the amplitude for down. So this is really conjugate to the spin variable itself. The phase is conjugate to spin. We know that S plus and SZ, for example, do not commute, and there's the usual uncertainty relation. So this plays the role of vector potential. If we remember Dirac's quantum electrodynamics, the electric field and the vector potential are the conjugate variables. So basically, the spins define the electric fields and the vector potential, and they live on the original pyrochlore lattice. Okay, so now the curl of this vector potential, basically. So we have vector potential variables living on these sites over here. The curl of this vector potential basically defines a magnetic field which lives on the center of these hexagons. And actually, if you look at the pyrochlore lattice, there are actually four types of these hexagons also, because they are defined by three of the four 1-1-1 type directions. And so these guys also form their own pyrochlore lattice. So the magnetic fields, if you like, they live on the center of these hexagons, which forms its own pyrochlore lattice, and their sources, then every time you have a pyrochlore lattice, you can define another diamond lattice. So their sources then will live on the second diamond lattice. So the quantum system, because of this possibility of superposition, actually has a dual set of fields and sources. Okay, so now we can put all this together basically. So we can have this gapless photon-like propagating modes, because fluctuating electric field on a site basically lead to change magnetic fields on nearby hexagons. And then you know you can have this tunneling, which allows this tunneling from one configuration to another. So that allows changes in electric fields at further away sites. And so basically, you can have a gapless collective mode that can propagate in spin ice. So this, of course, is only possible in an RVB phase with no bias in allowed configuration, because somehow if some configurations were not allowed, then these waves would not be able to propagate to the system. Okay, so I want to also mention that there's very nice work by recent work by Nick Shannon, who discusses what would be the signatures of quantum spin liquid in neutron scattering. Okay, I want to now talk about this question of, is emergent quantum electrodynamics actually realized? So Xiaogang was really pressing me on this particular question. Is this going to be realized in real materials? Okay, that's the million-dollar question, really. So one could perhaps begin by just saying that non-zero quantum terms are presumably always present. So what about these spin-iced materials like dysprosium titanium oxide or holmium titanium oxide? Well, the answer is, if quantum fluctuations are too small, that will not work. And there are at least two reasons for that. So first of all, quantum fluctuations will be overwhelmed by classical selection. So I took a model where you had nearest neighbor interaction, but that is actually not true. You always have dipolar interactions. In fact, it is known that in these classical spin-ice models, dipolar interactions are quite important. And dipolar interactions, they lead to a rough selection. There is a dispersion within the spin-ice manifold, which is of the order of 7% of the total dispersion. And so they already select a particular state. So if your quantum fluctuations are weak compared to dipolar energies, there's no way you're going to see this superposition of state being realized. So they can't be too small. Also, if quantum fluctuations are too small, the time scales will diverge and it will lead to a glassy state. That's exactly what happens in ordinary ice. So the fluctuation terms will be so small that the time scale to tunnel from one configuration to another will be unbelievably large. And so essentially, if the quantum fluctuations are way too small, you're not going to see a quantum spin liquid. Okay. This particular material has clearly, as we will discuss, substantial quantum fluctuations. It's an exchange-dominated material. It's also an effective spin half material. And in many ways, I would argue that it is really the best characterized quantum spin ice material. But it doesn't necessarily realize a quantum spin liquid ground state. Okay. So this material, the ytterbium spins, they form a pyrochlore lattice. Titanium is non-magnetic in this material. And due to large crystal fields and spin orbit coupling, it's basically an effective spin half system. There's a well isolated Cramer's doublet, which is well isolated from all other states of the atom, basically. So here is a measurement of the heat capacity, which goes back actually to 1970s, made by Blotte et al. And this is the heat capacity plotted as a function of temperature. One sees that there is a broad hump around 2 Kelvin, but then there's also the sharp peak around 250 millikelvin. Okay. So this data has been around for a long time, but really has not been explained and has in some ways also become controversial. Here is a proposed phase diagram from a large part of the work on this has been done by people here in Canada, I think a McMaster and a Waterloo collaboration. I'm mostly going to, the name I'm going to write is basically Kate Ross, and she seems to be the first author on most of the papers. So here is her proposed phase diagram looks like this. So this is temperature axis and this is the magnetic field axis. So at high fields, one is in a paramagnetic phase. And basically as one lowers the temperature in a field, one gets into a phase that she calls field-induced long-range order, because that is a phase in which one sees the onset of sharp spin wave-like peaks. Okay. In lower fields, as the temperature is lowered, basically she sees what are called rods of scattering. Okay, but there is no clear evidence of long-range order. And so she, in fact, calls this a three-dimensional short-range correlated phase. So this is actually, I put here a picture of this particular holmium material, which shows these so-called pinch points. So these rods of scattering are actually very common, if you like. So in momentum space, along certain directions, you see preferable scattering. And then the real signature of this spin ice the Coulomb phase, the correlations, is really this so-called pinch points where one sees at special wave vectors the basically this pinch-like region forming. Okay, so there's clearly nothing like that seen in this particular material over here. Okay, so the question of what happens in this material below this 250 millikelvin peak remained unclear. Okay, so in this new ice age really starts with this work in which also Kate Ross is the first author, but this is a theoretical work done by Savory and Balance, who propose what I think is going to be a very powerful method for all these systems, is to use the high field neutron scattering spectra, inelastic neutron scattering spectra, to determine the exchange parameters. So one can see that at high fields, this is the experimental data at 5 Tesla. And they fit the exchange constants so as to get the best fit with this data over here. And you can see that the fit is very good. And once they fit the spectra at 5 Tesla, they only fit the dispersion. The intensity is really also looks very good. If you go to 2 Tesla, without any adjustable parameters, they find that, you know, that the model is able to describe this material very well. Of course, below half a Tesla, you lose these sharp spin waves, which is part of the reason why this system is so interesting.
Rajiv, question. What is the pattern of order in high field spin order?
It's basically canting along the field direction, basically. Yes. So it's just a simple ferromagnet. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Hamiltonian, the quantum spin ice Hamiltonian, one can write down basically just based on symmetry. And one can show that it consists of 4 exchange parameters, which are listed over here, and 2 G factors. And there are these complex phase factors which are required actually to enforce the full symmetry of the pyrochlore lattice. But basically, these parameters, J's as well as these G's, were determined in that experiment that I discussed. So one question is, you know, does this model describe the thermodynamic behavior of this material? And if it does, then what is its zero field ground state phase? Okay, that's the question we want to address over here. And the question for theorists really is, how do we calculate thermodynamic properties of this material in a reliable manner? Okay, so one way that we can do that is basically by using high temperature expansions. So for any lattice model, quantum or classical, one can expand this Boltzmann factor basically in powers of beta, and the trace of various powers of H as well as with some operator can be calculated by straightforward but cumbersome method basically. And so any extensive property such as the free energy or specific heat can be expanded basically as a power series in beta. And if one wants to see how to do this, basically there's this book by Jan Oitma and collaborators that discusses how to do this using a linked cluster method in detail. Another method that one could use is basically a high field expansion. So suppose we write our Hamiltonian as H0 plus H1, where H0 is the field part of the Hamiltonian and H1 is the exchange part of the Hamiltonian. So if H1 is 0, it's very easy to solve just a single site problem. It's decoupled sites. And one can again carry out a perturbation theory in powers of H1 and again calculate these coefficients, for example, using linked cluster methods at zero temperature, and also at finite temperature this can be done. There will be exponentially small corrections at low temperature. Okay, one can also in principle study this by exact diagonalization basically. That's easy if the cluster size is small enough, but that really gets hard in 3D because in order to really do exact diagonalization with not too bad finite size effect, one needs periodic boundary condition. And periodic boundary condition really introduce artifacts unless the size is large. So for example, you know, at most one might be able to diagonalize a 16-site cluster on the pyrochlore lattice. But this cluster, each site is its own 4th neighbor in six different ways. As you go in different directions, you come back to the same point. So it clearly becomes less useful with increased dimensionality and coordination number. Okay, so the method that we've used is this numerical link cluster expansion. It sort of combines the link cluster ideas with the exact diagonalization. It's sort of a hybrid between the two. So we use the graphical structure of the link cluster method, that is, the property can be expressed as a sum over all clusters, a count of the cluster, which is called the lattice constant, and a weight of the cluster, which is the contribution of the cluster obtained by exact diagonalization, and this principle of inclusion and exclusion, which basically removes the contributions that have already been made by smaller clusters. So this has the advantage that this can be done, of course, for any set of parameters. It will be numerically exact at high temperature because it builds in the high temperature expansion. It's numerically exact at high fields because it builds in the high field expansion. And it has the correct short distance physics, basically. Okay, so it's ideal for spin ice type of a system. So in particular, if we look at this parameter space of H and temperature over here, so basically one can show that if we do this expansion up to some order, the weight of larger clusters which are not included will be down by some high power of 1 over temperature, like beta to the power 8 or something. So basically we have the correct high temperature expansion to some order. So the high temperature physics is going to be right. Again, it will have the weights correct to a certain power of 1 over h, like 1 over h to the power 6. So the high field part of the physics will be right. And it has the correct short distance physics built in. And if we use the right kind of clusters for ice spin ice systems, obviously we want to use the tetrahedral clusters because ice rules can always have a chance to hold, then it could possibly give us some information about this region as well. So let me just illustrate how this method works by discussing a calculation for the pure icing model on a pyrochlore lattice. Suppose I want to calculate not a high temperature property, but the zero temperature entropy, which was made famous by Linus Pauling. Suppose I want to calculate the residual entropy at zero temperature using this numerical link cluster expansion. So this is how it will work. So first, one has to consider a single site as a zeroth order cluster over here. The single site has an entropy of log 2. There's nothing to subtract, so its weight is just log 2, and its count is always 1. Then, so that at this order, we get entropy is just log 2. The first cluster then is a single tetrahedron. A single tetrahedron has 6 degenerate ground states. So its ground state entropy is just log 6. But then we need to subtract the fact that there are 4 single site clusters that have already been done. So one needs to do log 6 minus 4 log 2. So that's basically log of 6 over 16. And its lattice constant, one can show that number of tetrahedron per site is just 1/2. Is just 1/2. So the entropy at this limit is just log 2 plus 1/2 log of 6 over 16, which one can write like this as 1/2 log 3 over 2. This is the famous Pauling answer. So the first order calculation actually gives you the Pauling residual entropy. And Jan Oitma and I have actually done this calculation for the Ising model to up to 16 tetrahedron. And basically what we find as we do it at various temperatures is that this first order calculation for the classical model remains accurate down to T equal to 0 for the entropy, heat capacity, susceptibility, etc. to a few percent. So it's a remarkably good approximation for the classical model.
Why is that? Why do we get such a great answer?
That's because the reason is that many of these properties are determined locally. The local constraint is very important. There is some extra. You know, the entropy is somewhat different from this because there are some global constraints which are not captured by this independent approximation, but they are just small. So if we did, for example, the Kagome lattice, where we know the exact answer, there, you know, this first one one knows is good to about 1 part in 1,000. And of course, in two dimension, you have very, very few, you know, large clusters, really. So you have to close them. You have to make closed. For classical systems, actually, one can prove that if you have a set of clusters which don't form a closed star-like object, then they don't contribute at all. And so, you know, so this, which assumes that all the constraints provided by the tetrahedra are independent, is just remarkably good.
So is it in some sense the clusters don't really communicate?
There they don't really communicate. Yeah, they communicate very, very little, really. Mm-hmm. Yes. So most of the thermodynamic properties are gotten just by this single cluster approximation. Okay. So what we have done is really this numerical link cluster expansion for the quantum model to fourth order. And these are all the clusters that one needs. They're not that many in zero field. In a field, basically, each one of these turns into many separate clusters. But basically, this requires, in general, there are no lattice symmetries in these clusters here. One has to deal with this size of complex matrices. The exact diagonalization required about 2 to 4 gigabytes of memory, which was the limit for us. The next order will have 16 site clusters, and the memory will go up by about a factor of 64, which was beyond what we could do. So at high temperatures and high fields, obviously, this works very well. At low temperatures, an alternation sets in, which is the signature that longer range physics is becoming important. And some alternation can actually be eliminated using a trick due to Euler. If we had a long enough series then or sequence of terms, then one could use higher order Euler extrapolation and go down to lower and lower temperature. The one thing that is missing in this scheme is how to extrapolate for singular behavior and long range correlations. But we are not really going to enter into that regime here. So this is the result of our calculation. So first of all, this is the experimental data here. And this line over here, this is a log scale. The line, the blue and the green lines, they basically represent the third and fourth order numerical link cluster calculation. So you can see that below some that it agrees really well at high temperature. I'm showing it on a log scale here. And then at low temperature, they begin to diverge like this. If we use the Euler extrapolation, then it converges a little down to a little lower temperature, but then they also start diverging. So one would need really higher order Euler transformation, which we cannot do given the number of terms that we have in the sequence. Okay, I should say that there were other attempts to determine exchange parameters by Thompson et al. And by Chang et al., for example, and those give you very, very different data than the experimental data over here. So this is these circles are basically the data of Blotet et al. And this is what we get with the parameters determined by Ross and Balance and collaborators. The other methods really do not, the previous methods of determining the exchange parameters were really not appropriate. If we look at the entropy, this is really independent of the heat capacity really because for the following reason. So the entropy experimentally, one can get the entropy by integrating C over T, starting from low temperature, because the experimental data does not extend up to infinite temperature. So starting with low temperature, one can integrate C over T, and from the experimental data, get a plot of the entropy. Whereas in our calculation, we can start at high temperature and come down in temperature and measure the entropy. So first of all, these are the bare measurements, and then these are what we get after the Euler extrapolation. And you can see that at intermediate temperatures, basically the agreement is extremely good. So this is really a strong, another very strong indication that this model really describes this particular material very well. Okay, and that in fact this region. So if we look at the entropy and the heat capacity, it's clear that there is no clear plateau in the entropy, but the entropy is quite comparable, is very similar in size at these intermediate temperatures to this Pauling value. This dashed line over here basically shows the Pauling entropy. Okay, very recently Kate Ross has also done some measurements of the magnetization in a field along three different directions basically. And she has very carefully, they were done on two different samples with two different sample geometries. She has carefully done the demagnetization correction. And this is at high temperatures, at temperatures bigger than 2 Kelvin. So our theoretical calculation should be very good there. And you can see basically the dots are all the experimental data and the solid lines are the theoretical curves. But basically without any adjustable parameters, the model really describes the thermodynamic properties of the system very well. So it describes the heat capacity well, it describes the entropy well, and it describes the magnetization well. So the this model, I mean, so one of the basic messages of this talk is that this system, ytterbium titanium oxide, is very well described by a quantum spin ice exchange model. Okay, so the question then arises, what is this transition around 0.24 Kelvin and what is the physics of the system at low temperature? Okay. So unfortunately, for our full model, our calculations break down at low temperature. So obviously that cannot help us there. So what we are going to do is basically dial down quantum fluctuations. I had a parameter lambda in there. So all the quantum terms are multiplied by lambda. Let's see what happens at small lambda and then hope the physics is smoothly connected. We'll see what experimental evidence can actually be used to strengthen that. So first of all, so we have three terms, three quantum terms here, j plus minus, plus minus, or plus minus minus, and jz plus minus. In these materials, actually, this term is about 0.8 times jzz, whereas these terms are more like 0.15 times jzz. So these two terms are actually much smaller. This is the largest term. And we'll see that this term actually dominates the perturbation theory. So we're now looking for perturbative selection with all these three terms. So as I discussed before, these two terms actually do not lead to any selection up to second order. In third order, they give rise to the ring exchange. But this term already in second order leads to some interesting selection. Because this term leads to an interference, we can combine, this is a term with SZ and an S plus minus. So we can combine all the terms which flip a single spin, basically. So there is an Sj plus, which will be multiplying the z value, Sz, for all its neighbors with some phase factors over here. So it turns out that there's an interference between these terms, and this amplitude to flip it and come back is maximum when those spins which are on the same sublattice are oriented parallel to each other. So it actually gives you what is called a third neighbor ferromagnetic interaction between spins that are on the same sublattice. And this basically leads to a selection. So out of the infinitely many spin I state, it selects basically six ground states where this is a four sublattice system, every spin on a sublattice is pointing the same way. So if there are two in and two out, we have to just choose four out of two which are in, and the rest are out, and so that's basically gives you six ground state, and it also leads to a canting, a slight moment along the 100 direction. Okay, so one could ask, first of all, is this the what would happen in this small lambda limit? One can then basically study this model by a classical Monte Carlo, which was done by Tauran, and one finds that in addition to this peak in the classical system, basically, depending on the value of this J3, you will see a very sharp second peak and a first order transition. And actually, in this perturbative regime, the entropy will look like this. One would basically come down to this Pauling value, and then at really low temperature, the entropy will go to zero after you go through this first order transition. Okay, even though this model orders in this very simple way, that does not mean that there will be simple spin waves in this model. There will be spin waves, but they will be of a composite nature. And the reason is the following. When you flip a spin, you create this so-called monopole, anti-monopole, or spin-on, anti-spin-on pair. And it turns out that in first-order degenerate perturbation theory, this pair can begin to delocalize, because as it moves, the number of tetrahedra which are unhappy remains equal to 2. So there's no extra Jz energy, basically. The only energy cost is that there will be a string of broken bonds, and the string tension, if you like, is related to J3. And J3 goes as lambda square, whereas this delocalization energy goes as lambda. So that in the limit that lambda goes to 0, actually, the spin-on, anti-spin-on pair will delocalize over very, very long length scales. Okay? So these will be magnons. They will be bound objects, but they'll be highly composite in nature. And actually, there is a very nice paper by Oleg Chernyshov and collaborators where they've done a simplified version of this calculation, where they basically argue that in this kind of a system, what one expects is really a large number of states at a given queue corresponding to strings of different length. It would be very exciting if something like this could be seen experimentally. But we are actually working on this S of Q and omega calculation for this model in the perturbative regime, and we're not done. So does this picture continue to lambda equal 1? Well, the only thing, so first of all, if we calculate the entropy and the heat capacity at different values of lambda, we does see this short range order peak develop, and basically our calculation breaks down at a lower temperature. And so there's some evidence that the intermediate temperature physics may be something like this spin ice, but this doesn't tell us what happens at really low temperatures. Also, if we look at the one thing that one can say for sure is that it's not going to be a very simple picture, because if we look at the defect density, one can also calculate in the numerical link cluster expansion what is the probability of having these monopoles or spin-ons present. So in the classical spin ice, basically it will go down to zero as one goes to low temperature because they cost a certain energy. But in these quantum spin ice, one, as one goes below the hump, one is going into a region where there's a certain density of these guys being present. Okay, what this tells me basically is that there's a strong renormalization of low energy physics. This doesn't necessarily mean that there are going to be a lot of excitations present in the system. It just means that the low energy variables are not the simple monopole variables that one had in the classical limit. Those variables are going to be strongly renormalized, which is going to make it harder to see things. Okay, here's another calculation that we have done, basically the heat capacity in a field. And one finds that the heat capacity shows this broad peak basically in a magnetic field. And if one follows the peak values, they pretty much correspond to the phase diagram that Kate Ross had outlined. They follow very closely until one gets to a lower temperature. So this happens, so this is now a log scale for the temperature over here. So this peak comes down until about 0.5 Tesla field, where now this thing begins to develop a second shoulder over here. We are getting into a temperature region where our calculation breaks down, but basically a shoulder begins to develop and this thing becomes broader, and you can see it splits into two peaks. A peak goes down like this and a second big peak starts to arise at a lower temperature. So would be our calculations, of course, break down, but it would be very interesting if the experiments were done in this region and this kind of a breaking of this peak into two peaks was actually observed experimentally. Let me also say that if we look at the entropy at relatively high temperature, we actually do find evidence for this 100 ferromagnetic order. And basically, the evidence is that if a field is applied along this direction, the entropy goes to zero very quickly. Whereas if a field is applied along one of the other directions, one seems to be getting into some kind of a plateau region over here. And mean field theory actually shows that since this is the ordering direction, in this direction, it's like a gap system basically. Once you apply a field in this direction, nothing happens to the ground state until it starts to disorder, until it starts to cross over to the paramagnetic phase. But if you apply a field in the other direction, you will still get either two degenerate ground state or three degenerate ground state, depending on the field direction. And there will be a finite temperature phase transition. So the entropy, even at this higher temperature, the entropy is suggestive that this kind of ferromagnetic order will happen. So again, it would be very interesting if this could be checked experimentally. So I should point out before my conclusion that there's this very nice mean field theory done by Savary and Balance, who have mapped out the phase diagram in what they call this gauge mean field theory, where this axis here is J plus minus over Jz, and this axis is Jz plus minus over Jz. And basically, the experimental system is somewhere over here. So it's well into this ferromagnetic phase that I was discussing. But they have argued that in addition to this phase, this model has this Coulombic ferromagnetic phase, where there's ferromagnetic order, but also this, these Coulomb correlations, which are seen in the classical spin ice. And then if this term is Jz plus minus is really small, then one would get into this quantum spin liquid phase. Okay. And what is very interesting is that there are a lot of materials, and for some materials, one knows that this Jz plus minus is going to be zero. Okay. But again, J plus minus cannot be too small, because if J plus minus is too large, like in the erbium material, then one would end up with an XY ferromagnet. So there is, however, this window over here, which would be quite interesting. So let me give my summary for this, for these materials. Basically, ytterbium titanium oxide is rather well described by a nearest neighbor anisotropic exchange quantum spin ice model. It has this double peaked heat capacity, which is suggestive of short range order and long range order. if we simply dial down quantum fluctuation, then in the weakly quantum regime, there is an intermediate temperature, which is classical spin ice, intermediate temperature regime. And at low temperature, one has really a conventional ground state, but composite excitations. Excitations which are going to be highly non-trivial would be interesting to see. So we believe that the physics of ytterbium titanium oxide is basically essentially the same as this weakly quantum regime. It's a quantum spin ice, but not a quantum spin liquid. However, this still needs experimental confirmation. Let me just say that this is not the end of the story. So ytterbium titanium oxide may not be a quantum spin liquid, but we have the theoretical methodology in place by which we can determine the parameters very well. And experimental techniques are in place. In particular, we heard of some really beautiful instrumentation by Colin Broholm. And there's an amazing variety of spin ice materials. So I just put down the periodic table over here. Almost all of them of these lanthanides can be put in there, and several one of the transition metal can be also put in place of titanium. So Leon Balance made this claim at the HFM meeting that we should have a quantum spin liquid in quantum spin ice in the next 2 years. So that's very exciting. Thank you.